Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we go west with Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight and its bloody and often gorgeous views. And because so much attention has been paid to the presentation of this particular film, we'll talk about the theatrical experience and some of the ways it's changed and is changing. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. NPR Music's tiny desk isn't just any old office desk. It's become a stage for artists like Adele, John Legend, Sylvan Esso, Kacey Musgraves, The National, and of course, T-Pain without autotune. Now, if you're an undiscovered musician, you could play there too. Just submit a video to the Tiny Desk Contest for a chance at stardom. Find out how to enter at npr.org/tinydeskcontest.
We're in deep cinematic snow this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And back in his chair where he belongs, where we are always happy to see him, Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Welcome back, buddy. You were off last week. It's pretty tough for us.
Thanks.
And with us this week also is our friend Chris Klimek from the worlds of air and space and boxing.
Yep, that's the title of the magazine, Smithsonian Air and Space and Fisticuffs.
That's right. And what do you do for them when you're not with us at Pop?
I am an editor at Smithsonian Air and Space and Fisticuffs and a wandering ronin of a culture writer who occasionally has the very good fortune to write for you.
That's right, you sure do. Well, Quentin Tarantino has won 2 Oscars for the screenplays of Pulp Fiction and Django Unchained. He directed both of those, plus a bunch of other stuff he wrote, like Reservoir Dogs and Jackie Brown and both Kill Bills and Inglourious Basterds and even 2 episodes of CSI. His latest, The Hateful Eight, finds a motley collection of men attached in curious ways to the fate of a possibly doomed woman and holed up in a barroom to wait out a blizzard. The cast includes Samuel L. Jackson, Tim Roth, Michael Madsen, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Walton Goggins, Damian Bashir, Kurt Russell, and Bruce Dern. Chris, you were one of the people who, when we brought up this movie and said, who's interested in this movie, you had expressed interest.
I'm so one of the 8 most hateful people you know.
That's right. So how did you react to this movie?
You know, it's a sublimely discomforting experience that I was really happy to have. I went back and subjected myself to it a second time. A lot of troubling stuff in this movie that I'm sure we'll get into. I like that I have to process that all myself, that it has not been processed for me.
Pre-chewed for your protection.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pre-chewed stuff that we see in the film, but it's not the themes, it's not the narrative payload of this thing. Just on as a pure sensory experience, it's beautiful to look at. It's imaginatively shot. It's engrossing. Our sympathies kind of transfer themselves from character to character very rapidly, eventually finding really no place to land.
finding no purchase.
Yeah. But I love that. I love that sensation of being worked over and kind of destabilized throughout. I like that I never really figure out where this is going. It doesn't feel like a 3-hour movie to me.
Did you see the what version of this movie did you see? Because there are a couple of different ways to see it.
So both times I went for the road show at AFI Silver.
Since we
have the good fortune to have the ability to see a nice 70mm print of this, I took advantage of that. You know, I think the ideal way to see it, but I think that the standard theatrical exhibitions lack the intermission, which feels like more of a loss than the couple of minutes of footage that are not included in that version of the film.
Yeah, it's funny because when I saw it, I saw the regular theatrical presentation, and although you don't have the intermission, it's very obvious where the intermission is because it's when there's suddenly narration about where we are in the story. And I thought, this must be after the intermission. Because without an intermission, it's kind of strange because there's just a moment where you hear the voiceover saying, so it's about 15 minutes since we last saw our characters. And you're like, what just happened? Because you've just had a normal cut. Like in any other movie. And that's the version that I...
And is that narration Quentin Tarantino?
Yeah.
Or is
like
that...
It sounded like it, yeah. Okay. I certainly thought it was. How about you, Glenn?
You know, I didn't go into this film and get blindsided. If you've seen Quentin Tarantino films, he's made 8 so far, and he plans on making 10 and then quitting, you kind of know what you're in for.
Yeah.
And his films always seem like elaborate constructs that don't so much engage the world as they engage the history of film. They're about cinema. I mean, this kid grew up working in a video store, as I did for a while, and you can kind of close your eyes and picture him behind the counter. You know, you can kind of see him being very animated, and the store was in Hermosa Beach, California, I think. So he's, you know, trying to sell a bunch of surfer dudes on the films of Wong Kar-wai. He's very much about his influences. I tried to do the same thing with the films of Guy Madden to a bunch of suburban Philadelphia golf dads. We both had our crosses to bear. But he is a product of his influences, and he's very upfront about that. He talks about his influences a lot, and he does have his own voice, right? He could go into a Quentin Tarantino film, and you know you're in a Quentin Tarantino film, which is great. It's the fuel mixture of his influences, a little spaghetti Western, a little Hitchcock, a little Taiwanese cinema. It's all in that mix, and it varies from film to film. I keep waiting for him to transcend those influences, and I think he gets very close transcending them with Jackie Brown, because he's filtered through. He's adapting a book, the book Rum Punch by Elmore Leonard. He wrote and directed that film just like he's written and directed these other films. It's just there's something more, I don't want to say adult, but this film felt, as many of his films do, very boy. I don't mean male.
I know what you mean.
I mean boy. And there is a glee that he exhibits, but it all feels, there's always this scrim that drops down between me and his films. And it did for this one, too, where I'm reacting to it intellectually. I'm noting, as Chris mentioned, how gorgeous the cinematography is. I'm noticing the influences and the shout-outs and the homages. But it's a purely intellectual process. And he is wanting in this film to say something about race that I just don't think, because it is so much a construct, so much about movies, it doesn't feel like it's actually saying something about the world. It feels like it's saying something about all these other films that are in the world.
Interesting. How about you, Thompson?
I had some of that reaction. I did sit back and watch this movie and revel in how much love, and I do this with a lot of his movies, revel in how much love is put into it. Mm-hmm. I think he is a film nerd who genuinely, with all his heart, loves movies and makes them with that in mind. The score in this movie is by Ennio Morricone, you know, who's clearly somebody he idolizes. The camera work is so beautiful. It's, several people have said it's beautiful to look at. But it's in the service of something in this case that I just found, I'm sure Tarantino would not deny this, it is relentlessly punishing. And it is, of course it is violent. Much of it is violent in kind of grand guignol, like blood fountains, in a cartoonish enough way that like the violence of it didn't usually bother me, except when, and I know Linda is going to want to talk about this too, you have all these scenes in which Jennifer Jason Leigh gets punched and it's played for laughs. And that bothered me so much more than people's heads getting blown off and grand spectacular, you know, bullet flying in, spurt flying out. That stuff felt cartoony. The punching of the Jennifer Jason Leigh character, which is played as like wacky almost, it almost has like a boiling kind of quality to it when it happens. That's where the movie tilted into something like, this is a movie you either want or you don't. Mm-hmm. And generally you can self-select and you generally know going in whether it's a movie that you want or you don't. That's what kept tipping this movie into a movie I didn't want. And that's, you know, that's as much me as it is the film. But the film is very punishing, and that for me made it unpleasant.
I think it's important that none of the blows administered to Daisy initially by, I guess we should get into the count. Kurt Russell is the bounty hunter who is bringing her into Red Rock to collect his fee. So he's the one doing most of the abuse, although everybody kind of gets a turn eventually. Never has the desired effect. They never get the better of her, you know?
I don't know about that. I mean, I think I completely get what you're saying, and I've heard other people make this same point, that there is an irrepressible quality in her personality that I think they're trying to bring out, certainly. I can't remember the last time I saw a movie that was such an exercise for me in trying to figure out how to evaluate movies, because it is very easy to look at this movie and see all of the things that are not just skilled in the way that it's made, but brilliant in the way that it's made, I think. I mean, that score is ungodly beautiful. It is so amazing and perfect in every way. There are shots in this movie, including the opening, which is sort of a slow pull out on this kind of artifact that only gradually do you sort of figure out what it is. And it's really so smart and so gorgeous. And the way that they, even though I did not see the 70 millimeter, blah, 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 the use of the landscapes in many cases, even though they're sort of foreboding in that it's so snowy and desolate for much of the film, they're beautiful. It's beautifully done. And it is a movie where you sit and the entire time you just think about how thoughtfully composed mm-hmm. the shots in the film are, how carefully arranged the people in closed space are. And I think in terms of the writing, for me, I agree with Chris in that it doesn't feel long except at the beginning. At the beginning, the first time that I kind of incidentally looked at my watch and saw that I was only a half an hour into it, I sort of thought, boy, this is going to feel long. I don't think it's a terrible spoiler to say kind of the back half of the movie becomes this kind of closed room, whodunity mystery, which contains for me a little bit of a cheat, but that's okay, right? There was part of me that really was so there for that movie. I was so into it. I mean, the way that he writes people talking is always really fun to listen to. Mm-hmm. At the same time, like Steven said, I was very conscious the entire time of being asked to watch the only woman with a significant role in this movie. And when you get into any of the other women who actually appear in the movie at all, you don't do much better. But the only woman who has kind of a significant role in this movie being just punched and hit, and as Steven said, and that's consistently played for laughs. And I think this is not a novel thing to raise about this movie. This idea that it was, you know, misogynistic or whatever came up very early and has already been kind of batted down by Tarantino and by Jennifer Jason Leigh entirely, and by Harvey Weinstein, entirely on the basis of authorial intent. I know him. He doesn't have there's not a sexist bone in his body, which is totally the wrong question unless what you're trying to get at is authorial intent, as opposed to it's what Glenn always says about the thing you think you made versus the thing you made. Mm-hmm. And I think without casting aspersions on Quentin Tarantino as a person or as a person relating to women, you can say the product that you have wound up with, for me, is difficult to watch in that I am being asked to look at this woman being humiliated and basically treated like first an animal and then a monster over the course of the movie. And I think despite that quality of their kind of, I understand what Chris is talking about when he says they kind of never get the better of her. There are a couple of critics.
Well, no, and eventually they do. That's not the right defense for me to make. I guess what I meant is she never seems to exhibit fear. They want her to be afraid, and she's
never
afraid.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think that is the closest that I think it comes to giving her a little more humanity. I would argue that out of most of the people in the movie, she has the least opportunity to kind of be developed as a person who's kind of doing anything other than kind of being there in this experience. What I walked out of that movie thinking was largely, I really wish this guy's muse operated differently. He seems to have entered into a period of his career where what he's most fascinated by, he has all this brilliance and all this skill, and the thing that fascinates him the most is throwing a lot of kind of racial and gender stuff that he isn't really reckoning with all that well up on the screen for people to fight about and think about, which I get, but it feels to me like I would rather see something else.
I mean, to be fair, he's reckoning with more than just race and gender. I mean, he's trying to, in his own way, like relitigate past major conflicts. If you look at, you know, Django Unchained is relitigating slavery, and Inglourious Basterds is relitigating World War II, and this is looking at a, you know, Reconstruction Old West. You know, he's clearly kind of taking this grand vision of American history and putting all these people in a room. The only problem with the back half of the movie, which really does move along and is very exciting, it can feel a little stagey from a standpoint of we've put all these people with all the conflicts in America at the time and managed to put them in a room to hash out all of America's problems.
I heard the other day that he wants to adapt it for the stage, and I was like, makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was famously a stage reading. I can't remember if that was before or after the script leaked.
Yeah.
Now, when you were talking earlier, Chris, about your allegiances shifting over the course of the movie, I felt some of that too, but I kind of chalk that up to him not being as in control of his tone as he thinks he is, which is kind of what you were referring to, Linda. I mean, what he does is he sets up odious villains who exhibit horrible views and toss the N-word around and say incredibly sexist things, and then they are, spoiler, it's a Quentin Tarantino film, you know, bloodily dealt with in murderous ways.
Sure.
And they get their comeuppance. And it is so satisfying to like the reptilian forebrain, to some primitive thing in your head where a loop gets closed and it feels good, but that's not the same thing as actually encountering and actually doing anything with it. When you set up in Django Unchained a character like Leonardo DiCaprio as the slaver and you make him this awful person and some comeuppance happens to him, it's like, exactly as you're saying, you're relitigating history, which feels like a disservice to history. It feels like you're doing something that is cathartic in a way that feels easy.
See, but I think you're describing a more typical action movie or revenge thriller type arc, which I think even Django subverts. Now, I think Hateful Eight subverts it much more than Inglourious Basterds or Django does in the presence of, like, there's no one who we can empathize with as easily as the guys who are fighting Hitler.
So many of Tarantino's movies are ultimately about revenge. I mean, revenge is the through line
to
virtually every one of his movies, and Kill Bill especially. I mean, like, he's really fascinated with the concept, so... You know, some of it, I'm sure, is like examining like why we get revenge. There's all this talk in Hateful Eight about hanging versus killing the person and turning them in dead versus alive. You know, there's a lot of like honor among thieves and talking about how people pay for their crimes. I mean, all this stuff is stuff that Quentin Tarantino is obsessed with. But elements of it I really liked, but it really was like, I think I joked to you, Glenn, after we saw it, like I wanted to like go home and like watch The Revenant to cool off afterward.
I mean I think today, as we tape this, it's Tuesday, and people who follow me on Twitter, I was kind of hashing this out with a bunch of people today, is that my reaction to this movie was partly affected by the fact that, first of all, if I didn't like a lot of things about it, I would have said, this is horrible. I don't care about it. It's dumb, whatever. It's how much I admire a lot of the work that goes into this movie that makes it so difficult for me to figure out how to process, in particular, the fact that when I was at this movie, I was at this movie with, surrounded by a bunch of guys. And, you know, there's certainly nothing wrong with watching a movie with a bunch of guys. And none of these were guys I knew. None of them were, you know, any of you or anything like that. But when I was watching it, they did not laugh at any of the other violence in the movie the way they laughed anytime it happened to her. Because there are interviews with Tarantino where he's like, look, the point of this violence toward her is for you to look at that Kurt Russell character and say, oh, my God, he's a terrible. That's not what was happening in the room I was in.
Right.
I was so troubled by that reaction. And you can't. The artist is not responsible for kind of unpredictable audience reactions. But at the same time, I was so bothered by being in that room with what that was provoking in these guys, what I felt like it was provoking. It's just an incredibly complicated thing to work your way through. And I admire him, and not necessarily as a human, but like as a filmmaker, I do.
Sure. I don't know if I'd agree that it's an unpredictable audience reaction. The way it was shot, the way it was presented, was a pretty predictable audience reaction among, you know, that happened in the theater that we saw it in as well. The other thing that happened in the theater is that during the intermission, there was a line at the men's room because the audience was 98% dudes.
Yeah. Right. Well, and I mean, we were at the AFI theater, so it's not general population multiplex. I mean, it's nerds. You know, it's a self-selecting, it's dude nerds.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dude bros.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know. It's all very fascinating. I admire many things about the movie. I think all of us admire many things about the movie, and it has certainly stuck with me, so I'll give him that much. When we come back, you know, we've been talking about the formats and ways in which we saw this movie. We're going to talk a little bit about the theatrical experience, how it's changing, what's important to us in making that experience worthwhile. So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message come from TaxAct, the easy, fast, and affordable way to file federal and state tax returns. And TaxAct will guide you every step of the way. Start anywhere and finish anytime on your computer, tablet, or phone. If your deal is getting the best deal, go to taxact.com/pop and get simple federal and state returns free. TaxAct.com. You got this.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about The Hateful Eight. And if you've been following the release of this movie, you know that in certain parts of the country, but certainly not in all, there were opportunities to see this movie in glorious 70 millimeter. He shot it in Panavision, and they ran it with an intermission, like an old-timey movie used to have
Overture at the beginning.
Yes. Overture at the beginning. Did not see the overture. That part is not in the regular theatrical presentation. But most people are going to see it how I saw it, which is not the intermission. Not the overture on a plane. Not the intermission. Not the overture.
It's going to be great on your phone.
And not in glorious 70 millimeter at the AFI. But we got us thinking a little bit about the experience of seeing movies in theaters and all of this stuff that's been going on So first of all, we talked a little bit to Glenn and Chris about the presentation. I want to ask you, Stephen, about the presentation in 70 millimeter. I don't think of you as like a huge cinephile in terms of format.
Right.
I'm wondering whether you think it mattered to your appreciation of this movie that you saw it in this format.
Well, I think there is a part of me as a nerd that feels like if I'm going to have a cinematic experience, I should have the optimal cinematic experience.
Sure.
And so knowing that it's at the AFI, like a mile from my house, like even though it's $20 as opposed to, I don't know, $14 or whatever, you know, there's a part of me that's like, well, I should see this exactly the way that the filmmaker wants me to see it. If it's a filmmaker I care about, if it's a major movie, you know, if it's, you know, J-Lo and The Boy Next Door, maybe not. But, you know, I feel like a certain, like this weird almost obligation to try to see the movie like exactly as intended. But I tend to draw the line at like, if what Quentin Tarantino had said is you should see this in 3D IMAX, I would have been like...
Yeah.
The fact that it was...
I avoid 3D.
But there aren't any auteurs, really, who like 3D. I guess James Cameron, you know.
James Cameron.
Jim Benders is one.
Oh, right. Well, he made the documentary.
I mean, I will say...
And his latest James Franco movie.
Seeing The Life of Pi in 3D, like, that was a movie that really, really benefited from
it. Absolutely.
And was clearly made with that sort of thing in mind. And so, you know, I definitely seeing, like, it's been a long, long time since I've seen a movie in 70 millimeter. You know, I mean, certainly since I was old enough to care about that sort of thing. And I definitely went into it kind of trying to absorb myself in the feeling of the roadshow, which in this case meant long movie.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciated the intermission very much. I wouldn't mind a little bit more of that. For one thing, like after an hour and 40 minutes of that movie, to like slump down in your chair with a beer just made that last hour just zing by.
Well, and here's the thing, like the advantage to the way you saw it is that you saw it in the more proper cinematic way. But as everyone who listens to this podcast on a regular basis knows, I have a theater near my house with recliners. Mm-hmm. And if you go to the recliner theater, if I'm going to see a movie that's going to be almost 3 hours long, I want my feet up because I want to be in a comfy chair with my feet up. And I think, honestly, I'm sort of being glib, but I will defend the fact that the more comfortable you are and the less you're sitting there thinking about, I'm uncomfortable, I'm sitting in this seat for 3 hours, I'm too close to people who are breathing on me, the less I'm thinking about that, the more I'm thinking about the movie. So in that way, it is an optimal experience. You know what I mean?
I disagree because you talked about the recliner theater a lot. And every time I remain silent, but I got to come out and say it. I'm against recliners. I'm against reclining.
I'm against comfort of all kinds.
I have not lied down since 1974.
I want a bed of nails.
Something of it smacks of, can I say sybaritic? I think I can. It feels like Romans in the vomitorium, just reclining as entertainment happens.
But I do want to go back to the concerns of the cultured person here, one of which is this business about digital and film, because we have somewhat glossed over that to the horror of many people out there who are like, oh my gosh, you didn't talk about digital and film. And I was remembering today, there is a documentary produced and narrated and sort of conducted by Keanu Reeves, of all people, called Side by Side, which I really like a lot. And it's actually, you can buy it on your major streaming services, I think. And it is streaming on Netflix. So it's like roughly a little over an hour and a half. And he went out and talked to his credit, a good variety of people, cinematographers and directors and people like that, about shooting on film and shooting on digital. And if you're curious about all this format stuff, I enormously recommend watching this documentary. It's not hugely technical, it's very accessible, but it gives you a lot of the basics of this debate, because you've got, on the one hand, like people like David Lynch, who in the documentary at least, people like David Lynch who are like, I'm done with film, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And people like Christopher Nolan, who are like, oh, the horror, like the
yeah,
horror.
Yeah, he is not coming back to the Air and Space Museum now that we've ditched
he's
analog
horrified.
Projection systems.
And I feel like the documentary is very fair to both sides of that. It gives the film guys an opportunity, even as to a specific point, like when you shoot on film, you have to take the actual canister of film out every 10 minutes because that's as long as it lasts. Mm-hmm. And so you have built-in breaks. You have directors who work on digital saying, it's great because I don't have to stop. And then you have guys who work on film saying, it's bad when you don't stop because you need those breaks.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's really tragic, and this is where you get back to theaters, the thing that's really tragic is that the economics are not such that they're going to support both.
Right.
Because that's ideal. There are certainly people who make a great case for why they like to shoot on digital, particularly with certain kinds of movies, including like very artsy people who don't like dailies and don't like the fact that like you never knew exactly what you... There's like some great David Fincher stuff about not liking the experience of later seeing film that you didn't really know what it was going to look like, and you get a great performance, then it turns out it was out of focus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's great stuff like that.
You can find you can find arty people who shoot their movies on iPhones.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, yeah, Tangerine, of course, was like that. Now, I did see, I think the last theatrical movie that David Lynch made was Inland Empire, which, and I mean, that was 10 years ago. So, you know, digital photography has advanced, but it looked like crap. It did not look good.
Well, and there's a great section where they show some early movies that were being made when they first were trying to do like quote unquote video, which is not really what people refer to digital shooting as anymore. But like Chuck and Buck was one they show, and they show like how it looks cheap, but at the same time it was cheap. And they're kind of making that argument that like when you shoot cheaper, it frees up filmmakers to work with smaller budgets and therefore have more freedom, because everybody has more freedom when you work cheaper. Ask Louis C.K.
And you also, of course, I mean, we're talking about theatrical experiences, but it also really radically changes the experience of watching a lot of these things like on an HDTV at home. Like so many things, like when I got a, you know, gigantic 60-inch TV that, you know, and was watching things in HD, it's amazing how many shows look like they're shot on cheap digital cameras. Like, it looks almost like they're walking around with a camcorder, and it's very jarring at first. And so different formats work better in different, you know, on different size TVs versus movie screens versus...
I watched a movie with you recently at your house on DVD, and it occurred to me, I think you have your motion smoothing on.
That's horrible. My parents got a new TV a couple years ago, and it comes with that turned on by default, and it just makes everything look wrong in a way that's hard to articulate.
It makes everything look like a soap opera.
Right.
It makes everything look like you're watching a scene
it's
in a soap opera.
It's supposed to be good for sports, maybe, I guess, because you can follow the ball more easily. But
I was going to say, it's fine for football, so I'm going to keep it the way it is. My other movie theater thing is, and it is so self-defeating for the theaters, what I want in a movie-going experience is, if I want snacks, I don't want to stand in line.
Oh, and they're terrible. They're the slowest lines in the world.
It is the slowest lines in the world. And when you think about movie theaters, like, where do movie theaters make all their money? Concessions.
Yeah.
What has the most markup of anything on earth?
Oh, yeah.
Movie theater concessions.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, like, at the Regal Majestic in Silver Spring, like, there is a half-mile-long line.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
And I just never, ever, ever get snacks there.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing where if you have a single extra person getting paid by the hour will pay for him or herself with one bucket of popcorn.
I just want to point out that 90 seconds ago we were talking about whether David Lynch likes to shoot on film.
Yeah.
Stephen's like, also snacks.
Also snacks.
That's because this is a wide-ranging topic. But I will say, one time, and you will appreciate this, Stephen, I was at a theater in New York with friend of the show, Joe Reed, and we had a combination of these two things that you're talking about, because we stood in line between two women who waited like 15 minutes to get to the front of the line and then started debating what they were going to buy based on how expensive everything was.
Monsters.
So they were, oh, popcorn, $6. I can't believe it. And they start this conversation when they get to the front of the line. So I'm just saying, sometimes the overpriced and the long line work hand in hand to make you miserable.
I feel like there's this curious thing happening where the home viewing experience and the theatrical experience are kind of merging in a weird way, because home screens are getting better, you know, home surround sound and stuff. We've had that for 15, 20 years. The content divide, where, you know, everyone talks about how TV is better than it's ever been. You can do more ambitious and sophisticated things on television, whereas movies, where the one aspect that always appealed to me was that I'm getting a self-contained story. And, you know, I don't feel this pressure to keep up with 13 episodes or, you know, a whole season of whatever, except that movies are continually episodic now.
Yeah.
You know, so like all of these demarcating things are falling away. It does seem like a lot of these theatrical gimmicks to recharge attendance have been driven by television, certainly starting in the 50s. I brought in a little clip from The Brief Life of Smell-O-Vision.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
This is a little bit from 1960s Scent of Mystery.
Yes.
It is a man.
I have reason to believe that someone may be trying to kill you.
You'd be trying to sell me some insurance, would you?
Miss Jordan, I'm serious.
I have a friend who may very well need protection, too. Now, if you could dig up somebody cute for her, why, four of us could have a ball.
Is that the one? Is her life in danger?
Constantly, I'm sure.
Now, just imagine you can smell that conversation.
And that is, you said, scent of mystery.
Scent of mystery.
Miss Jordan, I'm serious.
Yes. You heard...
Sometimes I just want Glenn to do old-timey movie voices.
Indiana Jones's buddy, Marcus Brody, Denham Elliott, is the gentleman in that scene. He's talking to Diana Doors. And you heard Peter Lorre.
Deep cuts with Chris Clement.
Yeah.
So what would you smell in that scene?
So supposedly it was the mystery is that the clues would be presented in the olfactory realm. Wow. So like you would hear the guy's cigar at certain points, or you would recognize the lady's perfume, and this would help you identify characters whose faces were not shown.
Oh, the thought of having perfume piped into anywhere.
God. Do they call it 4D, the movie thing where like you jolt in the seat and they spray water in your face?
I was going to say, that is a solution to that snoring issue.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
No, I saw a short film somewhere where it was in that kind of theater where like your seat tilts and slants around. And then like if you're watching a movie where like you're going over water, they spray water in your face. And it was a little disconcerting. And I can't remember where I saw it.
But it wasn't a theme park thing? Like it was a regular movie?
Well, it was certainly a gimmick. I mean, it was certainly a come here and see this thing. But I can't remember now where in the heck I saw it or under what circumstances. But I'm pretty sure I wasn't dreaming. But I don't know. I mean, I think the interesting thing about this is, right, with all this, like, I prefer maybe to put my feet up. I prefer whatever. A lot of people don't go to the theaters anymore. There is still part of me, and it's purely nostalgic and romantic and all that stuff. I still really like dark theaters with, you know, trailers starting up. And there's still a little part of me that's like, yay, I'm at the movies. Like that still happens to me, and that is still the way that I would prefer, ideally, to watch movies all the time.
Yeah, it also feels like a sacred space to me, just like we're just going to do this for two and a half hours. You know, we're not going to get up six times and change the laundry or whatever.
I think that's the thing. It forces you to be a more attentive audience. I mean, I'm sure if you're talking about the filmmaker's intent, as we've talked about a couple times, I'm sure the filmmaker's intent is don't check your phone, don't do the laundry, don't take phone calls, don't. Just sit still, be a captive audience, turn off the rest of your life for 2 hours
and just do this. Yeah, which is why when the guy takes a phone call next to me, I become irate.
That would trigger a Quentin Tarantino style revenge thriller.
Yep. No, no, he was fine. No, he wasn't.
No, he's not fine. He's not fine.
He wasn't.
You can't defend him.
Monster.
Well, again, I know that many of you share our feelings about rude people at the movies, but I'm also curious about what you think about theatrical presentations. And did you go to the roadshow of The Hateful Eight? Would you go to more roadshows like that if they made more roadshows like that? Come and find us again on Facebook or on Twitter and tell us what you think. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. NPR Music's Tiny Desk isn't just any old office desk. It's become a stage for artists like Adele, John Legend, Sylvan Esso, Kacey Musgraves, The National, and of course, T-Pain without autotune. Now, if you're an undiscovered musician, you could play there too. Just submit a video to the Tiny Desk contest for a chance at stardom. Find out how to enter at npr.org/tinydeskcontest.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
This is not necessarily a movie that I think you need to see on a big screen. It is also a movie that several people have recommended on this show already. Audie Cornish, Gene Demby both loved it. I am here to recommend Spotlight, not a controversial recommendation. I went into this thing kind of thinking, of course, I've heard nothing but good things, but this is going to be like journalists are the real heroes. Mm-hmm. And I expected, especially looking at that very formidable cast, I expected a lot of grandstanding Oscar clips. Like I expected like an Aaron Sorkin take on it, which would be like he would install an editor, probably a woman, who was trying to kill the story, and then the hero editors who go against. And part of it helps that this story really only unfolded about 15 years ago. If it were as long ago as The Imitation Game, you would definitely have a lot of that same stuff. This movie makes so many smart decisions in what it doesn't do. I saw Adam Sternberg on Twitter made this great point where he said, in any other filmmaker's hands, there would be a scene in which one of the reporters has a brick thrown through their window that says, like, warning on it as they're getting closer and closer to this big story. They don't do that. And the other thing, and obviously we'll talk about all these movies when we do the Oscars omnibus and everything, this is such a tiny little touch. It's not a spoiler at all to say, you know, that at the end of this movie, there's a bunch of text that talks about what happens. It kind of ties some loose ends. And one loose end it never bothers to tie up is the fact that everybody knows, which is that these people won the Pulitzer Prize. Mm-hmm. Like, that is the reward for journalism. It's a terrible paying job where people don't like you very much, but sometimes people give you prizes and it's really important. It never bothers to say in the crawl of the aftermath of this thing, these people won a big award for it, because the movie's not about them. And so they're very important, but they're everything in this movie is in the service of the story. And I just enjoyed it and admired it immensely. Spotlight.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson.
See it in the widest screen possible. Yeah,
you could watch that movie on a TV the size of your watch. It is not a, not, no vistas.
All righty. Thank you very much, buddy. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two very different books. The first one is Kazuo Ishiguro's The Buried Giant, came out last year. And it's about an elderly couple in medieval Britain who slowly come to realize that their memory is fading. And it's not just theirs. It's everyone around them, everyone in their village. They are kind of losing the past. He writes very lucid, affectless prose. He wrote The Remains of the Day. He wrote Never Let Me Go. His characters exist at an emotional remove. Here, they also exist at a sort of memory remove, because they really are forgetting things. So they meet up with knights and dragons and creatures of myth as they go through this story. And what's interesting is that Ishiguro plays with time. So we'll skip ahead 2 days over the course of the story into a different character's head. So we don't know what just happened, in the same way that the characters don't know what just happened. I've read mixed reviews of this book since I finished it. And I was kept wondering, why didn't this show up on more best of 2015 lists? It's because a lot of the reviews I read felt that because of its subject matter, this loss of memory, and its very sort of fabulist approach, it must be an allegory. And let's crack this allegory. And I found I enjoyed it so much better, allowing myself to be kind of suspended in this ambiguity that he was deliberately creating and not trying to pin everything down. So I really, really enjoyed that, and I think it's worth your time. Second book is called The Comedians by Cliff Nesteroff. This is a history, a very well-researched history of stand-up comedy in America, stand-up comedy in particular, from its roots in burlesque and vaudeville. I like to think I know a little something about looking at many decades of history and sort of distilling them down, finding in all this research that you're doing the telling anecdote, the through line, and having to discard 80% of what you've researched just to be able to tell as clear as possible story. And he does that very well. Some of the heroes that emerge from this book are people like Red Fox and Buddy Hackett and Tommy Smothers in a really surprising way. It filled in a lot of the gaps I have. I think I, myself as a comedy nerd, I knew a lot of this history, but I didn't know it to this level of detail, and these connections that he makes I had never made. And of course, because who influences whom in comedy or any endeavor is not linear, sometimes his through line has to kind of double back and say, okay, now we're going to talk about Vegas, the rise of Vegas, and how this played it in. You're in great hands, and as you get closer to the present day, some of the analysis falls away. I'm also familiar with that, because there's less time to kind of see what is eternal.
Right.
And I missed that level of analysis as we get closer and closer and closer to the present. But it's a very engrossing read. It's The Comedians by Cliff Nesteroff.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week?
All right, I got three, so I'm going to go super fast. The first is the very welcome news of the relaunch of MTV News under the tutelage of the former Grantlanders. They've hired my buddy Amy Nicholson away from the LA Weekly to be their chief film critic. They got Molly Lambert, great music writer from Grantland. I expect great things. That's going to be awesome. Second thing, I've started reading Mark Harris's book, Pictures at a Revolution.
Oh, I love that book.
I read his World War II book first, because I had a story that I was writing for Air and Space last year that pertained to that. But I love his writing, again, formerly in Grantland. He's did the Slate Movie Club the last couple years. I know you talk to him on Twitter sometimes.
I do.
A great historian of cinema.
It's a wonderful, wonderful book.
And I am delighting in that book so far. The third thing is an item in today's Seattle Times about a young law student at Seattle University named Jonathan Nichols, who decided he needed to get a new phone number with a local area code while he was hunting for jobs there, and did not understand why he was getting racy text messages, invitations from car dealerships to come, you know, test drive expensive cars and stuff. And it took him several months to find out that he is now the owner of a phone number that previously belonged to a 52-year-old musician, one Anthony Ray, better known as Sir Mix-a-Lot, he of Posse on Broadway, My Hoopty, and of course, Baby's Got Back.
This is delightful.
Chief Bootnaka.
Yes. So Jonathan Nichols just has the supreme bragging rights of having the greatest cell phone number that I think anyone could have.
That's awesome.
Making me very happy.
That is wonderful. Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. I got books. I'm making myself into a person who reads books. I know. It's shocking. So I finished this week The Turner House, which is by mm-hmm. Angela Flournoy, which I think you talked about, Glenn, a little bit around the National Book Awards.
Yep.
This is a book about a family in Detroit that is dealing with kind of what to do with the old house that they grew up in. And it goes back and forth somewhat between the lives of the many kids in this family who are all now grown, but what that generation of kids is doing, and then doubles back to their parents and the lives of their parents and how they came to live in the house in the first place. It's an incredibly satisfying and very disciplined book in that you know when you hear that there are 13 kids in a family, I think it's 13, mm-hmm. kids in a family, that it's more than you're going to be able to really know. So you have to kind of take this author's word that she's going to guide you to the ones that the story is about and fill the other pieces in as needed. I think she's very disciplined in how she wrote this book. You will find that our pal Gene Demby is in the acknowledgments because this is a friend of his. But the reason I had read the book is that it was nominated for the National Book Award. It's really, really good. So I finished that. It's wonderful. I also read a book called American Housewife by a writer named Helen Ellis. It's a book of short stories, and they range from kind of semi-absurd to very absurd. Some of them are very dark. They're all about women in kind of housewife situations of various kinds. She's very good at writing these stories that gradually introduce you to a very dark idea that you kind of see emerging out of what starts off as a very lighthearted story. They're funny, but they're also, like I said, kind of sad and creepy in places. I like that book a lot, American Housewife. Also, I am part of the way through Loving Day by Matt Johnson, which I'm listening to the audiobook of. So all those books this week, plus news that the second season of Catastrophe has already aired in the UK, its second season, but it's coming to Amazon on April 8th. Mm-hmm. So we've got a little bit of a wait for that, but very excited about that. Always happy to see the return of Catastrophe. Come on, Catastrophe. So that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show and the end of my interest in books. No, I'm just kidding. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at IDislikeStephen and Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Chris at CTKLIMEK. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our In and Out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.